Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tortoise. Hi, it's Claudia, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. It's been over 2 years since Russia launched its war on Ukraine. But for me, one of the more unsettling and revealing moments took place in the early days of the war. Just weeks after Russian troops crossed the border, a nuclear power plant comes under attack. It's almost unthinkable. The fear of another Chernobyl suddenly feels all too close. In one video from the time, a man films himself on the nuclear plant's walkway. There's a hole clearly visible in the roof where a missile has landed. At this point, 5 of the 6 nuclear reactors are operational, while 1 is shut down for maintenance. Shots are fired at the power plant's control room. Over the intercom, a man begs the Russians to stop shooting. Nobody knows quite how far Russia is willing to go. Within the first 3 weeks of the war, Russia takes control of Europe's largest nuclear plant. During the fighting, shrapnel sprays the metre-thick containment walls around one of the reactors. But for many, there's a sigh of relief that the outcome isn't far worse. The Zaporizhia power plant has been captured, yes, but at least a nuclear meltdown has been avoided. Case closed. Only since then, another story has been unfolding. That attack on the plant was really just the beginning. Fighting in the region hasn't stopped. The plant has lost external power several times, forcing engineers to keep the station running on its own generators. And inside the power station, the occupation has had a terrible human cost. When it fell under the control of Russia's nuclear energy agency, many of the plant's original engineers had already fled. Those who remained were forced to work for the occupiers, their lives reshaped to keep the plant running safely. And for more than 2 years, that's what they've done. The fate of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the fate of the surrounding area, averting the risk of a wider nuclear disaster, all that has largely depended on the fortitude of a few Ukrainian engineers left behind to suffer under Russian occupation. And the danger isn't over. The plant's workforce has dwindled to about a third of what it once was. Just 3,000 people, where once more than 11,000, kept a nuclear power plant functioning and safe. Hidden behind enemy lines, their story was, for a long time, unknowable. Now, thanks to the testimonies of several former employees who were able to escape, and to the journalists at the Reckoning Project who have interviewed dozens of people, my colleagues Jeevan Varsaga and Nina Kuryata have been able to piece together what life has been like under Russian occupation for Europe's most important frontline workers.
They attached one cable to my little finger with a black binder clip and another to my earlobe. And they begin to ask the same question over and over.
It is a nerve-shredding tale. The story of what happens when a nuclear power station becomes a pawn in a war.
Even in peacetime, running a nuclear power station is a demanding task. Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is like a small city. The Soviet-built facility, occupying a sprawling enclosure on the banks of the Dnipro River, has six hulking reactors, each topped with a rust-coloured dome. Water, drawn from a nearby reservoir, is pumped through the system, keeping the uranium fuel rods cool all the time. There are experts in nuclear physics working in the control rooms, specialists in managing nuclear radiation and waste, and the engineers running electricity generation. Any mistake can have disastrous consequences. But perhaps the biggest risk is a sustained loss of the external power supply. That's what happened at Fukushima in Japan, when an earthquake and tsunami knocked out a nuclear plant's cooling system and caused three reactors to melt down.
Then a typical creeping occupation began.
This is Volodymyr Zhivoronok, a nuclear technician who was in his late 40s when the Russians invaded. He was living in the town of Enohoda, around 10 kilometers away from the power plant.
They took over the mayor's office, the prosecutor's office, the police. They took away cars from the police, tore off Ukrainian symbols from them, dressed them up with Z signs, and brought the military trucks.
He witnessed the early days of Russian occupation in the town. Life quickly got tough.
The Russian guards, special forces, Kaderovtsy, everyone was there. All were sent to cordon off the station. They are still there. The entire Russian army skimmed the cream of the local population as much as possible and robbed. They stole and sold, and so it went on. There was a large agricultural holding next to us. They produced milk, and I actually survived thanks to this milk. Because the first months we were simply tormented by hunger. I stood in line for bread for 9 hours.
Volodymyr made no secret of his loyalties. He had a Ukrainian flag hanging from his balcony. Enohoda is an industrial town. Its name literally means the giver of energy. Around 50,000 people lived there before the Russian invasion, many of them workers or the family of workers at the plant. So word and rumours spread fast, among them the idea that when the Russians came to the power plant they had inside information, so the soldiers knew where it was safe to shoot and where not to. That meant civilians were involved in the plant's takeover, and arguably that the Russians weren't as gung-ho as they first seemed. Over at the plant, things were slightly divorced from reality, for a bit.
Our workplace is special in a sense. We are cut off from everyone. That is, we don't really move around the territory of the Zaporizhia NPP. We have our own enclosed space there. There is a huge turbine department where you walk. I didn't see Rosatom employees with my own eyes, for example, because we are separated from everyone.
Rosatom is the Russian state-owned nuclear energy company. Zaporizhia has a total power generating capacity of nearly 6 gigawatts. That's enough energy for about 4 million homes. It's Europe's biggest nuclear power station. It provided a fifth of Ukraine's electricity before the war. And that was one of the reasons Vladimir Putin was determined to seize it. Instead of knocking Ukraine out of the conflict by laying waste to its infrastructure, Russia saw the power plant as a prize.
I think the idea was that they would seize the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant early in the conflict.
This is William Alberg,
the Director of Strategy, Technology and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies based in Berlin. They tried to remove it from the Ukrainian grid, hook it up to a Russian grid. You know, there was a real idea that this was going to be a sort of war booty for the Russians.
Those 11,000 employees at the plant stood between Ukraine and the potential for nuclear disaster. Yet, their introduction to the Russian occupiers was almost corporate.
Well, the first time I encountered them was when I went to work on the morning shift. Before they let us into the plant, an employee of the Physical Protection Service that deals with the security of the plant briefed the staff on how to proceed and how to do what, so as not to provoke the Russians.
Dmytro Klevakin was one of the 11,000 original employees at Zaporizhia. He's an electrician. Kostyantin Chabayevsky was a fellow employee.
I was on my way and understood there was no choice. I had to go. At that time, the power unit was still operational, so we had to go. I could not process any of this in my mind. How was it even possible that a nuclear power plant could be captured like this? And when you are going through the plant and understand that all physical safety principles, based on internationally recognized principles, suddenly collapse. And you go, and you don't understand it all. Some unfamiliar soldier is standing there and letting you through, and it is apparent that he is used to holding an automatic rifle in his hands.
Despite the violent takeover, the plant remained intact.
There were some emergencies that we dealt with. I can say for myself that there was no critical damage to the plant.
There was damage, but it was superficial. The new Russian regime, though, meant there was some chaos.
We were scared to go to the canteen. At some point, it became unclear how food would be brought in. However, later, somehow, everything was organized. I saw them only when I went to work, from work, and to the canteen. They organized a real military base at the station. I didn't talk to them, obviously.
Life carried on. It was surreal, but it continued. It had to.
My facility, my workplace, is at the first gate. It was blocked there. We were all brought to the second one, but there was no one at the gate.
This is Kira. That's not her real name. She spoke to the Reckoning Project anonymously.
We were given transparent bags and went in. We were supposed to be met by officers at the checkpoint to check what we were bringing in. Nobody met us. The gatehouse was completely open. Only the passport control system was working. We went through and we saw a pile of things from the guys who were from our military unit, who were there directly guarding the territory. Their things, bottles, meals, everything, helmets, medicine bags, everything was just lying around. Not just a bunch of stuff, but all scattered. Here, the wrecked cars of our military unit were also standing. It was not a good scene.
Russia gradually took over the running of the plant.
In about 6 months, they started to interfere with the system of the nuclear power plant. They interfered in its operation. They dictated to us and told us, "You switch to new documentation." The Russians created new journals for us. They said, "You must now maintain them according to the standards of the Russian Federation to comply with all legislation."
The plant used to run under the directive of Energoatom, that's Ukraine's state energy company, but the Russians quickly brought them under Rosatom and changed all their guidance to Rosatom guidance. Kira didn't deal directly with the Rosatom employees, but she said many of them seemed scared too.
They brought us people who said they will study to be shift supervisors right away. You see, they are scared themselves. They themselves said that they were given such conditions from other stations that either you work or you are fired. They say, "We are not happy, we don't want to be here."
FSB, state security agents, military personnel, Rosatom employees, and the original Ukrainian workers were all now coexisting on the plant, yet living separate lives. For those Ukrainian employees who had remained, work got much more difficult. War brought its own challenges. As Russia pounded Ukraine's energy infrastructure with missiles and drones, the nuclear plant repeatedly lost access to external power, forcing it to rely on a reserve power line or its own diesel generators.
Our work became more vigilant, more attentive because of the constant blackouts. We were always on surveillance, working on the control panel. We were watching every parameter. Our actions had to be more rapid than a normal, peaceful operation.
The risks were high.
There are constantly outages. The station needs to be maintained with a huge amount of kilowatts. We need power to keep the station just idle, and we get this from the Ukrainian energy system. There is only one line, it's so thin, and they break it all the time. They break it, they break everything. The station is de-energized, and it's off limits, which shouldn't happen. There are backup diesel engines, but the diesel engines will not be able to support this entire system for their own needs. The 6 units. It's a lot, and it will lead to an explosion. The pumps that take the hot water out will stop working, and it will just overheat and explode.
Operating in wartime conditions under duress from Russian occupiers, the job at the plant was already treacherous enough. Then people began escaping the country.
Then they started taking children out, mothers with their children. Fathers stayed behind to work to support them somehow. Eventually, it got to the point where we were short-staffed from June. And we worked 7 months on a 3-1 schedule, 3 days on, 1 day off. When the norm is 3 days on, 2 days off, because of the storage of staff.
That meant staff numbers began to dwindle and working hours began to grow. Blackouts, armed soldiers patrolling, and amid all this, growing pressure from the Russian invaders to sign contracts with Rosatom and become fully fledged Russian citizens. As some people fled, others were arrested.
It happened on August 27, 2022.
On June 24, they broke into my house.
I was on my way home from work, and they stopped me at the entrance checkpoint.
Volodymyr Kostyantin and Dmytro were all detained in the summer of 2022.
They were dressed in civilian clothes, in balaclavas, with assault rifles. They broke into my apartment, put on handcuffs and put me in a car.
I used to go out on the roof sometimes to catch a connection from the other side of the river. Our phones worked poorly, but still worked. Well, I was outside 5 minutes at the most when the hatch that I climbed through opened and some young man came out on the roof. He pulled out his gun and fired a shot in the air.
All three men were taken to the local police station and held in crowded cells. Dmytro's ordeal was comparatively short-lived. He was detained for 2 weeks. The other two men were less fortunate.
Many of us in the cell had injuries. I also got hit in the side from traumatic rubber bullet. And everyone asks, where are the weapons? Where are the drugs? Where is the National Guard? Where is the SBU? Who do you know? Who do you know? They didn't differ much in terms of questions.
They put me in cell number 3. They told the chief inmate of the cell to apply some kind of physical violence to me, but refrain from punching me in the face. That was what they told him. He repeatedly told him that, to make me write a confession note there.
The objective of the torture was, it seemed, to obtain information. The Russians suspected that civilians were passing information about military positions to Ukrainian forces. The men were taken to a different room where they were interrogated.
If you don't want to talk, they turn on the electric current. What do you know? You say, what can I know? I'm not an employee. A man broke wooden bars on me and used electric shock torture, which was called Call Lenin. They put a metal clip on my ear or toe. I was tied to a chair, and then they turned on the current. They tortured me with electric shocks, and then they used rubber buttons or baseball bats or wooden bars.
The guys told me that they use electric shocks produced by a military, some kind of a phone, and I see something that looks like it. Overall, they call this torture a phone call to Lenin. You kind of sit down and they start to attach to you. They attached a cable to my little finger with this kind of a pin and another one to the earlobe. And that's it. They start repeatedly asking the same question and begin to turn a knob. At this point, the electrical charge starts accumulating. It goes straight from the little finger to your head. Everything goes dark and then you see white lightning. And all this is repeated. They ask you this question. At some point, you don't even know at all what to say, because words are lost.
They deliberately tortured people there so that you could hear everything in the cells. Who is being tortured? When they're being tortured? You could hear so much there. And the whole room was covered in blood. All the walls are splattered with blood.
Tears start coming out, and saliva, and you fall. They hold you so that you don't fall off the chair. Many said that they were tortured so often. They were tortured so often with electric shocks, particularly, that even these chairs often broke under them.
Both men continue to suffer from the effects of the torture.
I still can't recover because for almost 2 months I was without movement. My legs atrophied and I can't walk.
It was strange to walk again. My legs hurt because I got out of habit. Then I made it to my workplace, told there about what happened. A week later, I left.
The cells were filled with men like them, beaten and tortured for whatever they might confess. Some men died there. One of them was a diver who worked the nuclear power plant's water tanks.
There was also Goncharuk Alexander, who died, a diver of the Zaporizhia NPP, 50 to 60 years old. Apparently, they was trying to persuade him to cooperate. They had information that someone was hiding a weapon, so they tried to hold him accountable. He was severely beaten. I witnessed his last breath.
Ukrainians at the plant and living in the city were routinely arrested and tortured, accused of spying on behalf of Ukraine. The men were eventually released and they fled. The risk for them was too high. But that meant leaving behind people like Kira, who continued to work at the nuclear power plant with ever-dwindling resources. Ukrainian employees who stayed on to work at the plant say they were coerced into accepting Russian citizenship and signing contracts with Rosatom. A spokeswoman for Rosatom denied this and denied that any employees had been tortured. But Russia wasn't just brutalizing the workers at the power plant. It was doing something without precedent, using the nuclear power station as a base for military operations. The Ukrainian military said Russia launched rockets from the nuclear facility and concealed military vehicles in at least two of the reactor buildings. Over that first summer after the invasion, there was repeated shelling in the vicinity of the plant itself. Each side accused the other of targeting the nuclear facility. Ukraine claimed that Rosatom employees were advising the Russians which areas of the plant they could deliberately shell without triggering a disaster, and Kyiv admitted that it had struck back at the Russians, in one case hitting a military camp at the power plant with a drone strike. The shelling that year was causing real damage. One explosion punched a hole in the roof of the building that stores fresh nuclear fuel and solid radioactive waste. Another took out an electrical transformer and two backup transformers. The IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog, made its first wartime visit to the nuclear power plant when Volodymyr was in a room just a few kilometers away being tortured. That was in August 2022. By this time, the facility was down to just one of the four external power lines needed to stay operational. All but one of the reactors had been shut down during the Russian occupation, but the fuel inside all of them is still hot. This is Sean Burney, a nuclear specialist at Greenpeace.
In the loss of cooling, which could happen through loss of electrical power, 1 to 2 weeks is probably the time period that we have if they lost all cooling function. For the water to effectively drop down below the level of the fuel, these are large vertical fuel rods. Once the fuel becomes exposed to air, it starts reacting. The fuel rapidly heats up and the external material, the cladding of the fuel, basically starts burning and heats up dramatically, releasing hydrogen gas in very large volumes. And of course, ultimately what then happens is all the water boils off, the temperature of the fuel rises to 2,500 degrees centigrade and it melts. And then you get the fuel dropping to the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel, burning its way through the reactor pressure vessel. You would have by that point almost certainly an enormous release of radioactivity into the atmosphere.
But the Greenpeace expert says the greater hazard comes from the spent nuclear waste that's been removed to pools of water elsewhere in the facility to cool down.
Because it's years of fuel that's been removed from the reactor pressure vessel and put into the pools. So each pool is multiple reactors and there's six pools. Get your head around it, there's six reactor cores with fuel and six spent fuel pools. So in terms of the radioactive inventory, the amount of radioactivity that's on the site, it's enormous, much larger than, for example, at the Chernobyl plant. That doesn't mean you'd get the same amount of radioactivity being released. The range of scenarios is almost limitless. And that's not to talk about what we think is also a real distinct possibility, which is deliberate Russian sabotage at a certain point.
And that's where Russia's occupation of the nuclear power plant and the abuse of its staff has broader consequences. In normal times, in a nuclear power station, there's a well-trained and well-drilled workforce who know what they need to do to avert a disaster. At the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, there's now a diminished workforce under intense psychological stress. Sean Burney again.
It could be 100 times greater than Fukushima, 20 times the cesium volume released by Chernobyl, which is the largest nuclear disaster in history. That doesn't mean those are going to happen, but those are the sort of numbers that are unfortunately available for the Russians to use as an enormous psychological threat to the European population. And of course, it's not a question of hoping. We have to stop a disaster happening in Zaporizhia, which means we have to bring as much pressure to bear on Rosatom.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
We turned this very water into demineralized water for the operation of the units. The water in this cooling pond is from the Kakhovka reservoir. It's just like a big bathtub. Now we take water from there.
Kira's job was to help cool the reactors. They got the water from a reservoir created by a dam, the Harkova Dam, on the Dnipro River. The reservoir's a mammoth body of water. Local people sometimes call it the Harkova Sea. The water from this reservoir filled a cooling pond, which was several square kilometres across, like a big bathtub, as Kira put it. But then, in June 2023, Russia did something that seemed inexplicable. It blew up the dam.
Now, these images are from areas downstream. You can see absolutely remarkable scale of it all, really. The water levels could rise by as much as 12 metres.
And perhaps the most bizarre part of this, from Russia's point of view, was that the Harkova Dam was in their territory. They'd claimed it, and the nuclear power plant. And now, because of their actions, the plant was at real risk. The question of why the dam was attacked by Russia has never fully been answered, though the prevailing theory is that they did it to stop a counter-offensive from Ukraine. It made the job of people like Kira substantially harder. Keeping the plant safe, never mind keeping it going, was a real trial. The power station's management began looking for new sources of water, drilling groundwater wells. The cooling pond itself, containing many months' supply of water, remained intact. The dam was destroyed on the 6th of June, 2023.
And on the 20th, I was kidnapped.
Kira had lasted a year longer than the men before being arrested.
They took me away, put a rag on me, locked my dog in the cottage. No neighbors, nobody was there. I realized by the turns that they were taking me to the police station, our police station, which they occupied. And there they started beating me, asking me where my boyfriend was. I say, I don't know. They say, you don't know. And then they put these clothespins, crocodiles, and they put them on my ears and started shocking me.
It's worth saying here, Kira and the two men, they don't know each other. When the Reckoning Project interviewed them, they had not spoken to one another, but their accounts corroborate each other.
I don't know anything. I don't know anything. I was lying there. I saw it later when it was just the rag they put on me. It started to slip off because they were beating me like that. They hit me in the head with a pipe many times.
For so long, it's felt like the biggest threat to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is its maintenance, its staff, whether the resources exist for it to be maintained safely. In recent days, though, there's been an alarming reminder of the risk posed by the war. Last week, there were drone strikes on the nuclear facility, a reminder of how the plant finds itself in the middle of a war zone. It was the first time since November 2022 that the plant had been directly targeted. A team of inspectors from the IAEA, the nuclear watchdog, has been stationed at the power plant since the summer of 2022. The inspectors said that a drone had detonated at one of the nuclear reactor sites where surveillance and communications equipment appeared to have been targeted. In a separate attack, Russia said another drone had struck the roof of the facility's training center. It's not yet clear who was responsible. Both sides blame each other.
And that's the thing is, you know, on the one hand, you could say it's logical that the Ukrainians would do this because they're trying to hit Russian troops near the facility.
William Albuck has worked on overseeing the upgrades of Soviet-era nuclear facilities and worked for various government departments, including the U.S. Department of State.
But on the other hand, you know, this could be a false flag attack. This could be Russia doing it to itself in order to try to blame the Ukrainians, make the Ukrainians appear to be the irresponsible party. This is something, you know, Russia has made up all kinds of nonsense throughout the conflict, including the idea that Ukraine was going to build its own nuclear weapon or its own dirty bomb or use chemical weapons. You know, we've seen this kind of nonsense throughout the conflict.
Both sides have a possible motive, but William believes Russia's history of pushing disinformation in the war makes it a likely candidate. Either way, the latest attacks show what's at stake.
It's irresponsible, it's reckless, whatever is at the plant. This is inside the perimeter of the plant, not far from one of the reactors. Yes, indeed. This is extremely worrying.
The head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, has been releasing regular updates since the attacks.
It would take not just a drone hit, it would take drone hit after drone hit after drone hit on the same place in order to sort of crack the containment.
The worry is not in the reactors being hit directly, but the supporting infrastructure.
The chance of a nuclear explosion at the facility is unbelievably low. I mean, almost zero. The chance of some sort of radiological release comes from the chance that one of these attacks might damage the electrical power that goes into the reactor. So if you damage the systems that are governing these hot shutdown reactors, you might end up with the chance for a larger release of radioactivity. But this would be known, you know, once it happens, the damage. The IAEA has been very good at illustrating every time something has happened that has in any way threatened reactor safety and security. So we can expect Russia to parade out some more lies and weirdness.
The IAEA has been criticized for its inability to change Russian behavior. Greenpeace's Sean Burney believes that the presence of the IAEA on site at Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant only enables Russia.
Unfortunately, I think what they're trying to do is really not very possible under the current circumstances. One of our criticisms of the IEA, that they, over the last year and a half, a bit longer, have almost normalised this situation, that a nuclear plant under Russian occupation on a war zone is anything but a massive hazard, and it can be sustained, and it can't be sustained.
William Alberg, it's fair to say, disagrees.
I think the IEA has actually done unbelievable work, really unprecedented work, in terms of, I mean, the Director General himself leading a team of IAEA inspectors to go to a facility under occupation in the middle of shelling all around. I can't imagine his predecessors doing that. It really is unprecedented. So even now, they are constantly and consistently trying to pressure Russia to give them more access to more parts of the facility. You can go to the IAEA website right now, and there's an update from the Director General from, I think, yesterday on the situation at Zaporizhzhia Nuclear Power Plant. And this is one of, I think, 221 updates on the Ukraine conflict that the IAEA has put on their website. It's truly an unprecedented amount of attention. At the same time, it's incredibly great and responsible that they're doing this. This is why we have international organizations like the IAEA. This is a part of the conflict that most people would forget if there hadn't been an incident directly there. But the fact that the IAEA is willing to put people in the line of fire, to demand access from an occupying power, to go through enemy lines during a conflict and to access and to provide provisions for these folks, to try to support the Ukrainians who continue to operate the facility.
In the early days of the war, Russian forces took over the power plant with the aim of keeping it intact. They believed Ukraine would fall within weeks, and they wanted to keep the infrastructure running so they could bring it under their jurisdiction. The nuclear industry is, don't forget, a growing business for them. But when Ukraine didn't fall, their warfare evolved, and that includes disinformation. The IAEA continues to monitor the plant. In the latest update, it warns that the drone attacks significantly increased the risk of a nuclear accident at the site. Kira was released from custody after 6 days. She got out as soon as she could, taking a bus to Ukrainian territory, leaving her pet dog with a relative and carrying a half-empty backpack to avoid attracting suspicion. Her focus turned to restoring her health after the torture and seeing her young son, who'd got out separately. But she hasn't stopped thinking about the people she left behind.
The people there are literally like a human shield now. The Russians could definitely harm them if they wanted to.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. Please do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was reported by me, Jeevan Vasagar, and Nina Kuryata, with special thanks to the journalists at the Reckoning Project, without whom this story would not have been possible. The producer was Matt Russell, with sound design by Dominic DeLaghi. The editor was Jasper Corbett.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.